Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Balance is important in our personal lives, and balance is so essential to governing ourselves that the American Constitution centers on a balance of power between the three branches of government. But what happens when that balance is lost? Our guest, Jeffrey Toobin, is a senior legal reporter for CNN, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and author. Mr. Toobin's books include The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. We need to know about this critical third branch of government, he says. Nowhere is that more clear than the one-time-only decision the Supreme Court made in 2000 when it appointed George W. Bush to head the executive branch as president. Mr. Toobin says at least one justice was so disturbed by the lack of balance in this decision that he considered quitting the court altogether.
It was Souter who was so devastated by Bush v. Gore because he has this idealistic notion of the court. And sure, people can disagree, but he thought that was such a cynical maneuver that he actually thought about resigning the court. The court is a political institution. It's insulated in some ways, but it can't be insulated in every way. You know, Stephen Breyer is the only justice who always goes to the State of the Union address. And he says that he does it for a reason. He says, look, we are part of the government. We can't pretend that we're not. And the justices don't like going. It's awkward about whether to applaud or not. They just feel out of place. But Breyer says, no, we are a part, and we need to show people we're a part.
Jeffrey Toobin's bestsellers also include Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life about the O.J. Simpson trial. Mr. Toobin was ABC's legal analyst before joining CNN as senior legal analyst. And prior to 1993, when he joined the New Yorker magazine staff, he served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn and as an associate counsel in the office of independent counsel Lawrence E. Walsh, investigating the Reagan administration Iran-Contra scandal. With so much at stake in the hands of the current Supreme Court, Bill Russell and I were confident a lively conversation awaited.
Jeffrey Toobin, I have a friend who I think has tired of the fact that every time she sees me, she first says, everything's political with you, Paula. And then she says, how can you be so passionate about government? And I say, how can you not when there's so much at stake?
Well, and that's especially true of the court. You know, one of my favorite sayings about the court is Justice Robert Jackson, who said, we are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final. Someone in America has to have the last word, and in our society, in our government, it's the Supreme Court.
Well, I think most people won't recognize Justice Jackson's name, but he was very important through the Roosevelt years.
Right. He was a former attorney general under Roosevelt. He had political ambitions of his own. He is probably best known as the Nuremberg warrant, the lead prosecutor. But tragically, he died young. I think he was 62 when mm-hmm. he died, and he didn't have that long a career at the Supreme Court. Interestingly, I believe he died in 1956. He was on the court that decided Brown v. Board of Education in 54, but he was the last justice to die in office before William Rehnquist. So many justices were old, but they all managed to retire before they died, except in between Jackson and Rehnquist.
Well, and Rehnquist clerked for him, didn't he?
And Rehnquist clerked for him.
There's some stories around that.
There's some controversy about Rehnquist wrote a famous or infamous memo mm-hmm. That he claimed was in the voice of Robert Jackson, but other people had asserted it was his own view that Brown v. Board of Education was wrong, the idea segregation should have been permissible.
Doesn't sound like Justice Jackson.
Well, it doesn't, and some of Rehnquist's fellow clerks said just that.
Well, and this also goes to, and you talk about Justice Stevens in a relatively recent decision saying that, you know, the court I joined would not make this kind of decision with respect to, it was an affirmative action.
Well, that was the affirmative action case, not affirmative action, school integration
right.
case
right.
At the end of last term, which came out of Louisville and Seattle, mm-hmm. where the school district, on its own, not forced by any court, said, look, we want integrated schools. We think diversity is a value. And the court ruled 5-4 with an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts that that was a violation of equal protection, that you could not use race in that way, even if it was one of several factors. And Stevens wrote a very passionate dissent, and it was a very sort of meaningful debate between the justices, because it was really, what does Brown v. Board of Education mean? The majority said Brown v. Board of Education means you simply can't consider race in where people go to school. The dissenters, including Stevens, said, no, the point is we want integration, and the government is allowed to take steps to make sure that schools are integrated. And it was a profound disagreement.
And there are a lot of intervening cases that both the Supreme Court but other courts have ruled on.
In addition to the University of Michigan.
That is a relatively new interpretation or a serious change from what the courts had been saying fairly recently.
Well, that case, which was decided on the last day of the term in June 2007, really was the culmination of the new conservative majority asserting itself. And, you know, in the famous words of Justice Breyer, it is not rare in law that so few have changed so much so quickly, referring very explicitly to his new colleagues Roberts and Alito, that the law is changing on abortion, on church-state relations, on civil rights. And I don't think there's any doubt that Breyer is right.
It is the nine that has brought us together with Jeffrey Toobin. We'll all be back in just a moment. Please stay with us. Jeffrey Toobin is with us, having written a number of very important books, including The Nine. When you quote how it is rare in the law that so few have changed so much so quickly, what I kick back in my memory bank is Winston Churchill talking about the few who had the very famous line that I may or may not get rightly, it is rare that so few have done so much for all of us. And yet it's part of this larger story you tell that is almost as if it's the evil twin.
Well, I don't think that's a fair characterization. You know, one of the themes of the Nine is the growth of the conservative movement. And starting in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan came to Washington, conservatives decided, look, you know, the Supreme Court has not been our friend for a very long time. We need to organize a comprehensive critique of the Warren Court and the Berger Court. And they started the Federalist Society, which was an organization which allowed conservatives to meet together and share ideas. And young lawyers came to Washington determined to help in the cause. And two of the most prominent and most intelligent were young Samuel Alito and young John Roberts. And what they did in a somewhat halting way, and it was not an entirely smooth trajectory for the conservative movement, but between the 1980s and 2007, where we are now, conservatives have come very close to taking complete control of the Supreme Court.
The idea that you take that from the 80s forward, you also make a fairly good argument that this is really about the New Deal.
Well, it goes back to the New Deal because, that was the first time the Supreme Court really got in the way of an executive in a sustained way. And Franklin Roosevelt engaged in the court packing plan, which was a failure, but retirements and changes among the justices basically took care of it for himself, took care of the changes in the court that he wanted without having to add the number of justices as Roosevelt wanted to do. But part of this intellectual conservative revolution of the 80s was critiquing those decisions that approved the New Deal.
That allowed the government at the federal level to have very real input in what happened at the local level. And you say, he laughs, and you say that as we think about what happened with the New Deal, that it's the first time that the courts got in the way of the president. But it's also the first time in a long time that the courts got in the way of business.
Well, that's right. And you know, the New Deal was, by and large, progressive change from the left. And it was conservative justices who stopped it. And it was Roosevelt justices who approved it. And, you know, again, one of the conservative causes, and this hasn't had much success yet, some, is limiting the size of government through constitutional change. There was a famous case in 1994 where the court invalidated the a law that said you can't possess a gun near a school. And they said, look, that is not what the federal government is supposed to do.
Was that the Brady Bill?
That was not the Brady Bill. That was a later case. It was about the Brady Bill. This was about this was just about guns near schools. And the court ruled 5-5 that this was outside Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. And it had been the third
5-4.
5-4, right.
You said 5-5.
Oh, did I say 5-5?
Which is going to be a major part.
Yeah, that's
talking about black and white.
Roosevelt tried
that. Extra justice. No, 5-4, that the court, that this law was outside the commerce power of Congress. Now, that didn't really go anywhere. The justices pulled back from using the Commerce Clause to invalidate acts of Congress, but if the court stays and gets more conservative, they could change again.
Talk a little bit about the Commerce Clause, because I think most of us occasionally see it go by. It sounds obscure. It sounds like it really doesn't, you know, it's esoteric. It's something lawyers talk about and really has very little to do with the life I live, and yet it is in many ways dead center of the political environment and really the social environment we inhabit.
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, the framer set up is that the federal government is a power of government of limited powers. Mm-hmm. The federal government only has the powers that are delegated to it by the Constitution, and all the other powers go to the states. And one of the powers in Article I is the power to regulate commerce among the states. Now, what that has meant in practice, virtually all the regulation of the economy that we think of as routine, minimum wage laws, pollution laws, laws about unfair competition, antitrust laws, all of those laws come from that little phrase that says Congress has the right to regulate interstate commerce. And starting in the New Deal, once the Roosevelt justices took hold, Congress essentially, the court essentially said, look, if Congress believes that the law has some effect on interstate commerce, we're not going to second guess that. We're not going to, and even if it's a lot of small transactions that add up to an effect on interstate commerce, we're not going to second guess Congress. That is one of the conservative bugaboos that you know, you should tightly more limit what constitutes interstate commerce.
There's an interesting mixture in this. I was fascinated by the degree of influence the movement conservatives, as you characterize them and as they're generally characterized, have had over the selection of Supreme Court justices, the nominations, under Republican administrations for some time and increasingly.
Well, see, I mean, that is one of the stories of transition. When you look at the Reagan presidency, movement conservatives did not control all the appointments. Ronald Reagan's first appointment, of course, was Sandra Day O'Connor. And the only thing he was looking for was a woman. And there were not a lot of women to choose from among Republican judges. And he found, frankly, a very obscure judge in Sandra Day O'Connor. And her views on abortion were barely looked at. I mean, it was not the factor that it later became. Later, you know, he appointed first Scalia and then Rehnquist, promoting Rehnquist to Chief Justice, a conservative, but again, a very uncontroversial nominee. But then came 1987 and Robert Bork. And that showed that there was a limit to how conservative you could be. And that debate in the Senate, which was controlled by Democrats, went very much about issues like privacy, abortion, civil rights. And Bork, of course, lost. And as a result, Reagan was forced to nominate a more moderate justice, Anthony Kennedy. Moving ahead to the Bush years, you know, when William Brennan quit, the Berlin Wall had just fell. George Herbert Walker Bush wasn't particularly interested in the Supreme Court. He sort of grasped David Souter from anonymity and said, look, let's get him in. He's not, he seems like a reasonable enough person.
Well, it was Mark Rudman, I think.
Warren Rudman and John Sununu, who was his chief of staff, two New Hampshire fellows vouched for him. But again, the right wasn't in control then. At that point, once it became clear that Souter was not going to be a movement conservative, conservatives said, look, no more Souters. We you owe us. And that's where you get Clarence Thomas. And then, after the two Clinton justices, you had George W. Bush, a far more conservative president than his father, and also a more conservative party, saying, look, we care about this, the Supreme Court, as much as anything, perhaps more than anything. So we want sure things. And that's why you get Samuel Alito, that's why you get John Roberts, and that's why you don't get Harriet Myers. Harriet Myers was rejected not because of her thin qualifications, but because the conservatives didn't trust her to be 100%er.
Well, and Gonzalez as well. I mean, those are fascinating stories.
Right. Well, Gonzalez was vetoed even before he had a chance to be nominated. What a remarkable fall.
Sometimes you get lucky.
Well, you know, it's just incredible to think that, you know, Alberto Gonzalez came to Washington in 2001 as White House counsel, former Texas Supreme Court judge,
Hispanic, which would ordinarily...
Just people thought he was a lock to be on the Supreme Court, and instead leaves Washington in disgrace before the end of two terms.
The movement piece of this, the social conservatism, is a big chunk of it, and really I think is at the center of a lot of what you're writing about with this court. The business perspective, the corporate perspective that has also been central to the Republican Party for a long, long, long time, perhaps from its very inception, and certainly since Lincoln's death, that piece doesn't jump out as much, and yet, in some ways, the result of having these justices nominated and approved and now serving is that business interests are now much better represented than they've been, certainly since the New Deal.
Let's come back to that in just a moment, and I will keep this short. Yes, we'll return in a moment with Jeffrey Toobin. Be with us. Jeffrey Toobin is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about the interests of business being represented on the court better than they've been in a very long time, or not.
Well, one reason why the Republican Party has done so well in recent years is that you have this synergy between the traditional low taxes, sort of libertarian business interests, and the social conservatives, anti-abortion, anti-gay rights people.
Those social conservatives are very religiously oriented.
Religiously oriented, right. But the joining forces has been very significant. Now, one of the potential costs of the Bush presidency, and this is more political than legal, is that the business conservatives may be checking out of the social agenda. You have situations, and one of the cleavages that I write about in the book is Sandra Day O'Connor, who really comes from that libertarian Arizona Barry Goldwater tradition that is different from the social conservative tradition, and she really becomes quite alienated with the Bush presidency because, you know, while she signed on for limited government and states' rights, she didn't sign on for John Ashcroft, for the limitations on civil liberties in the wake of 9/11, for the war in Iraq, and especially the Terri Schiavo case.
Well, and the whole paternalism that she found so reprehensible in dealing with women across the board.
Right. I mean, you know, that was always an issue for her for obvious reasons. I mean, here is a woman who graduated near the top of her class at Stanford Law School, and the best job she was offered was as a legal secretary. So, you know, some have said she's always had a more acute radar for discrimination against women than discrimination against blacks, because, you know, that's what, you know, she experienced herself.
And also, what you didn't mention is she also reacted extraordinarily harshly to the current government's attitude about the Geneva Conventions, about torture, and about the tortured logic of both the President's Counsel and the Justice Department and the military.
Well, one of the unexpected things I discovered in writing The Nine was how much the international travel of the justices influenced their jurisprudence. I mean, it's most true for Anthony Kennedy, who teaches every summer in Salzburg, spends a lot of time abroad. Also true of O'Connor, also true of Breyer, also true of Ruth Ginsburg. That these justices meet with their counterparts who are very interested and very responsive to what's happening in the United States. And they these American justices, the ones I just named, feel like, well, we should pay attention to what's happening over there. And the Geneva Convention is sacrosanct among European countries.
Absolutely.
Well, in much of the world.
International Criminal Court, sacrosanct. The death penalty, anathema. Gay rights, much more powerful there than here, with some exceptions. And if you look at Anthony Kennedy, basically a conservative man, in the areas where international, where the international community is arrayed against the United States, like a Geneva Convention, like gay rights, like the death penalty, he's definitely moved to the left.
Well, and you talk about these justices paying attention to the rest of the world. In an era of globalization, that's just common sense.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, it may be to you, but, you know, Justice Scalia responds, and they've had these debates both in public and in the pages of the Supreme Court opinions that, look, you know, the American Constitution is the American Constitution. It's not the French Constitution or the German Constitution. And you know, we can respect our foreign compatriots, but they are not, we shouldn't take advice from them.
In fairness, we had a conversation some years back with a senior thinker at the Democratic Leadership Council or Conference, whatever they call it, who I asked him three times if there was anything we could learn from Europe in a political way. And three times he said, nope, they can learn from us, we can't learn from them. So this is, you know, this kind of parochialism is not unique to justices of the Republican Party. There's a certain nativist streak in Americans. But there's also a sense, and I think we all grew up with it, that America had perfected democracy and that we were on the true path and the rest of the world needed to get in line.
Well, I mean, you call it nativism, they call it nationalism, mm-hmm. patriotism, mm-hmm. so I mean...
I call it patriotism, too.
Well, we'll see that. It's one of the hot debates.
And it's one of the tensions that has been in this country since our inception.
Absolutely. I mean,
this
you know,
goes
whether
back to before we were a country.
Isolationism
Absolutely.
Versus internationalism. Woodrow Wilson, George Washington, they've all dealt with these
well,
issues.
Well, we had a group of friends over, 30 or 40 people on Saturday night, and mostly similar political perspectives. And somebody was ranting about something or other, having an aggressive, intelligent discussion. And I said, you know, one of the interesting things that I keep going back to is the election of 1800, because it was one of the nastiest elections this country has ever had. The behavior of both candidates is somewhere between atrocious and reprehensible, and certainly their representatives. They were just developing parties. The media was beneath contempt. So this is not new in this country. I think there's some new attributes to it, perhaps. But this is an ongoing struggle that this country has had to deal with, and continues to deal with. And I think part of the challenge is a lot of us thought that was done,
what is the famous William Faulkner line? You know, the past is never gone. That's not even past.
Right? Yeah. It may not even be past.
Right, yeah.
And it's important. You know, and it makes work like what you do, but and historians very important because we tend to have such a short horizon that we lose track of the flow of history, the ebb and flow of history. And go ahead.
Well, but there are moments when history changes.
Absolutely.
And there is ebb and flow, but then there are moments when and one of the reasons I wrote the Nine now. Is that the Supreme Court may be near one of those moments.
Exactly. And you think perhaps next year or two or three.
I do, because you know here you have a situation where the court is divided and polarized more than it's been in a long time, you know, with Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas on the right,
on the hard right.
Right, with the conservative right, with Stevens, Souter, Breyer, Ginsburg on the left, Kennedy in the middle, usually siding with the conservatives. But looking ahead, Justice Stevens is 87 years old. Justice Ginsburg is 76. David Souter is 70 and doesn't enjoy the job very much. So we are likely looking at three of the four liberal justices leaving in the next few years. So the election of 2008 is especially central to the future of the court because, you know, if a Republican appoints those three replacements, you know, we're looking at easily a generation of very conservative justices. But frankly, you know, I think that's how it should be, because you know the framers set up a system where the president gets to put his or her stamp on the court. And if we keep electing Republican presidents, as we have more often than not in my lifetime, how could the court not be conservative?
I want to go back to this, the history piece. There, almost everyone talks about the pendulum of history. It swings one to the left, it swings to the right, it swings to the left, swings to the right. What you're saying, I think, is also important, though. That frequently is the case, but there are times when history really does change. And to sit back and with your arms folded, and I think it's the point of your essentially your epilogue, and assume that you know it will inevitably swing back to where you want it to be, and you can catch it going by, is not necessarily the case. That you can in fact have a dramatic shift. I mean, the founding of this country was in some ways a dramatic shift, in some ways it wasn't. But there are times when history actually does change, and the flow of life, history, politics, culture, and everything that goes along with
it. And the court doesn't necessarily follow in lockstep with the rest of society. I mean, clearly the 2006 elections, we had a swing back to the left. And I think President Bush, even if he had a chance to appoint a Supreme Court justice now, I don't think he will, but you know, would have a harder time getting his choice through. But you know, if a Republican is elected in 2008, even if the Senate remains Democratic, you know, the justice will be conservative. I mean, you had that situation in the 30s. You had President Roosevelt elected with, you know, enormous majorities in 1932 and in 1936, but the Supreme Court had not yet caught up. So the court was at loggerheads with the administration. Now, because Roosevelt kept getting reelected, he got to shape the court in his image. But the only way the Democrats are going to be able to reshape the court is not through having senators, you know, fighting with the president over appointments. It's to having presidents making appointments.
Well,
in
some ways that makes sense in the checks and balances in the broad sense, because what essentially you're saying is they're out of phase. That you know is I think is this court is so much more conservative, I think, than the country as a whole.
It's an interesting question.
I say that, and it really is a question, because so much of the influence. In reading your book, I said if I had to just pull something out, I would say Miranda and Miranda. The two Mirandas. One is the decision that we're all familiar with about reading rights, which is sort of symbolic of a liberal court, progressive court, liberal court, call it what you will. And the other Miranda is a guy who got fired from Frist staff or removed from Frist staff. I think that's right.
Oh yeah, Miranda. Yeah,
who sits in his office, townhouse, room, whatever, with his computer, his laptop, a long email list, a cell phone, and has had a tremendous amount of influence on the selection. And I say all that because part of this is the single-mindedness of the movement conservatives, the focus on the court, particularly in the last few years, that has had a surprising influence that is not generally reflective of the body politic.
And Jeffrey Toobin will pick up from there when we come back in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to be with Jeffrey Toobin, who has written The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court at a Very Important Time in History. We were talking about the long sweep of history, and I will get back to that after you two talk about Miranda and Miranda. But that history piece is so relevant, it's quite exciting.
Well, these are actors, I mean, the latter Miranda, and both of them, really, are agents in history in some very interesting ways. They may be representative, they may just be symbolic, but they both seem to be reasonable symbols within this context.
Well, you just raise an interesting point that, you know, how much does the court reflect the body politic? And I don't know what the court does. I'm not sure where it stands now. But Sandra Day O'Connor, who really dominated the court for her last 10 years on the bench, had this extraordinary political acumen, I think, who would sometimes drive her colleagues crazy because she seemed to view the job more as a politician than as a justice.
Which she had experience being.
Right. She was the majority leader of the Arizona State Senate. And she would lead the court to compromise positions that were astonishingly faithful to where the most people were. Now, she's a supporter of abortion rights early in pregnancy, but approved things like parental consent laws. She approved the use of affirmative action in admissions, but in a limited way without quotas. You know, over and over again, you could see O'Connor with this remarkable radar for the political center. I'm not sure there's a member of the conservative majority now who has that kind of priority. Well,
Kennedy probably thinks he is, though.
Kennedy thinks he is, but I mean, he is not, whatever else he is, he doesn't have the common touch. I mean, this is a guy who was very very sure of his own.
You mean the red carpet and the stars?
Yeah,
the,
you know, very, very sort of full of pomp and circumstance, and has never been elected to anything. I think one of the unfortunate aspects of the court is that the backgrounds are also similar. This is the first time in history that all nine justices had served as judges previously. Never happened before. The court that decided Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, not one of the justices had been a judge previously. You know, I think some sort of mix of professional backgrounds would be would serve the court better rather than as sort of the top of the civil service chain.
You also,
it's also the ideological representation that you document wonderfully in the nine about how it isn't just the Supreme Court; it's the full federal judiciary that the political right wing, the conservative movement, have made it a real priority to make sure that their perspective was represented on the bench. And then we hear over and over again, "Oh well, we don't want activist judges."
Well, you know, again, the nomenclature is a political weapon. And you know, conservatives have captured, you know, judicial restraint and judicial activism, and they're for the former and against the latter. But in fact, you know, when you look at a case like the Seattle and Louisville mm-hmm. school cases, where the democratic process worked and the schools were desegregated as the community wanted, you know, the conservatives on the Supreme Court said, "No, we know better." Now, is that restraint? That sounds like activism to me. Another decision was the Kelo decision, which was the eminent domain case, where in the city of New London, Democratic elected legislators said, "Look, we think this urban development program is good for the community. We're going to take a couple people's houses and turn them over to a private developer." Well, and the liberals, Justice Stevens' opinion, said, "Well, you know, we're going to defer to the political majority. We're not going to get in the way." Conservatives were furious. Well, that was actually, it seemed like judicial restraint. So, you know, it all depends on whose ox is gore, I think, how these terms
yeah,
were.
There's one of the major subcurrents, particularly, you know, from the conservative perspective, is to go back to the Constitution more or less as it was created.
The originalists?
The originalist, what John Dean calls a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. What is interesting about O'Connor as a representative of the court for that long period of time, and really is the most powerful, influential person on the court, is that she evolved. The laws have evolved since 1787. The country has evolved since 1787. And I find myself wondering how serious this originalist perspective is, or is it a rationalization for undoing decisions that have been made, particularly those starting in the New Deal, coming into the 80s, that we just didn't like?
Well, I don't doubt that it's sincere. I mean, I think the justices identified with originalism, chiefly Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, are sincere. But there are, as Justice Breyer has written in a recent book called Active Liberty, a lot of problems with the originalist idea. First of all, you know, the framers of the Constitution didn't seem to think that their intent should control. Also, how do you interpret what their intent was? They also intended, at the time of the Bill of Rights, that slavery exists. Is that something we're supposed to honor? But obviously there were the later amendments. How do you interpret the intent of the amendments on top of the intent of the original Constitution? I mean, it gets very complicated and probably impossible. But the subtext of originalism is a conservative political agenda. It means the Constitution does not protect the right to abortion. It means that the government should not engage in any sort of racial categorizing at all, even if it's designed to help people who've been discriminated against. So, you know, yes, it is true. I mean, I don't doubt the sincerity of the originalists, but let's not kid ourselves about whose interests are served by originalism.
Which takes me to a very interesting line you have in The Nine, where you say that the conservative movement's agenda, as reflected in the court, if I understood you rightly, is abortion and everything else.
Well,
where does women's rights come into this? Ruth, I'd never seen it before, but Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, saying, guys, this isn't about equal protection or privacy. This is about equality.
Right. Well, you know, one of the criticisms of Roe v. Wade has always been that Harry Blackmun wrote the original decision as a right of privacy decision, which is not mentioned in the Constitution, and the decision is actually even written as if it's the doctor's right to perform the abortion. Ruth Ginsburg, even before she was a judge, had said, look, I believe that the Constitution protects a woman's right to choose abortion, but under a different theory, that if you force women to continue their pregnancies against their wills, they are not being allowed to be equal in the society. So she has a much more simple equal protection argument. Interestingly, in the last abortion case that the liberals lost, four justices embraced Ginsburg's rationale rather than the privacy rationale. So if somehow the Democrats get more appointments, maybe the right to choose will be anchored differently in the future on the equality theory rather than the privacy theory.
I was very interested to hear John Dean, whose book we happened to be reading and with whom we were in conversation in the last 10-day slot, the tremendous changes that would take place if, in fact, this became a court dominated by what he calls judicial fundamentalists. But it's real easy to just say fundamentalists. And when we look at the large world, and people, especially in America, get all kind of frowny about, oh, well, there are fundamentalists out there. Well, shouldn't we be looking at home as well as abroad to people who react in fear in ways that are very traditional? That's the nicest way I can say fundamentalist.
But I think this is a real political debate in our country. There are a lot of people who think traditional values are good. Republicans have won lots of elections in recent years by appealing to traditional values. You know, religious fundamentalism in America is something that a lot of people embrace and think is a great thing. So I don't think it's fair to sort of apply a label and say, well, it's automatically bad.
It is important to apply a label and say, do you want this?
Absolutely. I mean, that's you know, one of my main purposes in this book is to say, look, these are choices. There is no such thing as law independent of ideology, independent of politics. These are decisions that the society is going to make.
And individuals are very important. But this
right.
This is not neutral.
One of the things that John Roberts said in his confirmation hearings, which I really disagree with, is that the Supreme Court justices are just like baseball umpires. All they're doing are calling balls and strikes. No, they're more like the commissioner of baseball. They're making the rules. Now, they can make good rules or bad rules, but they are making rules. And that's what I think is, no one should be mistaken about that.
It's very clarifying reading this. There's a tendency to, and lawyers frequently will do this, judges will do this, to assert that what they are doing is uncovering the truth, is embedded in the law, or at the very least taking the original intent and applying it in specific circumstances, and it is essentially, not their words, but a scientific process. You take the words, you apply it. And that has never been the case, and it never will be the case. It is what makes democracy so important, and the active engagement of people across the spectrum, not just at the court, but also as voters, as jurists, the whole range of participation.
When you're talking about constitutional law, I am very uncomfortable with the uses of the term right and wrong. Outside of a certain sort of basic agreement that everybody has, they're not about right and wrong. These are choices. These are largely political choices that the justices make. And I think we need some truth in labeling. Now, you may agree or disagree with them, but it's really it's about choices, not right and wrong.
And well, the choice I'm making right now is to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jeffrey Toobin. Be with us. Jeffrey Toobin is with us here on The Paula Gordon Show. A great pleasure. I went back to one of your two current employers, not CNN, where you go next, but to The New Yorker. And I think the very first thing that I found in my wonderfully archived New Yorkers, which is a fabulous resource, was what I think was your first contribution in 1993. I could be wrong, but it was way early. And you were saying that it was you said outrageous. It wasn't just bad, it was outrageous that President Bush, George the First, George H.W., had given parole, had said it was okay that the last of the Iran-Contra people would not go to court.
That's very good research. I think that was the first thing I ever
wrote
for The New Yorker. Wow.
And while it was good reporting and it was well balanced and it did reflect your time working with the special prosecutor on the Iran-Contra, it was very clear that you didn't think it was right to stop the democratic process, to stop the lawyering of which you are certainly one, mm-hmm. and just say, oh, it's okay, we're not going to talk about Iran-Contra. And in fact, there have been tremendous repercussions over the last 20 years that we didn't stop Reagan and say to Reagan and all of the people around it and that Oliver, that we didn't pay attention to Iran-Contra.
I'm not sure we didn't pay attention, but
we didn't pay enough attention.
Well, maybe we didn't pay enough attention, but I mean the issue of the conflict over separation of powers, you know, that historically I think what Iran-Contra is a story about the president trying to expand his powers at the expense of Congress. And Dick Cheney, who was on the Iran-Contra committee, wrote a dissenting report that he himself has cited as a blueprint for what this current administration has tried to do. And if you look at the Guantanamo cases, there's going to be a new one up this year as well. I mean, these controversies are fresh. And one thing the court has done over the past 4 years is cut back on the president's power in this one area, but Anthony Kennedy, who was usually sided with the conservatives, has always sided with the liberals, at least so far, on these Guantanamo cases about the Geneva Convention, about presidential powers. We'll see with the new justices who wins those cases, but you know, as you point out, these are fresh controversies.
They keep keeping history fresh. That was, I guess, my only point.
You wrote about in a full book, and in this this book reference the what was styled Bush versus Gore as being maybe not the lowest moment of the Supreme Court, but one of the lower ebbs of the Supreme Court. And I'm interested in you, since you are a scholar of that institution, a juxtaposition of that as a less than noble moment in the history of the court, and what you would construe as the other side of that. What is one of the really fine moments in the history of the court, particularly in recent history?
Well, I think Bush v. Gore was a bad decision, and the nine is not, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down on every decision.
Right.
I mean, it's mostly descriptive, it's mostly analytical, but I couldn't help myself when it came to Bush v. Gore.
Because you'd written a whole book about
right,
it.
Yeah. Well, and also because, you know, I think one thing justices owe us is ideological consistency. You know, if you're going to be in favor of states' rights, if you're going to be against an expansive reading of the Equal Protection Clause, you have to do it in a case where a Republican's ox is gored as well, and I don't think the majority did it. I think one decision that reflected how the court has changed and how society has changed is Lawrence v. Texas. It's Justice Kennedy's opinion saying that the state of Texas cannot criminalize consensual sodomy between men, and basically says you can't make people criminals for who they are. And I think that was an example of the living Constitution at its best. Clearly, in the 18th century, there would have been no doubt that that sort of behavior could have been criminalized. But society has changed, and the Supreme Court has changed, and the institution has changed. And one of the things I write about is how in 1986, when Bowers v. Hartwick was decided, which upheld that kind of prosecution. You know, gay law clerks were still mostly in the closet. By 2003, you know, there were gay law clerks out in the open, and this, you know, the justices are sheltered, but this was something that they're not sheltered from, and I think it was hard for at least some of them to say, you know, I can't look at these people every day and think that they're criminals.
That's an important point, because you also talk about the cynicism that can easily develop by people who spend all day every day in Washington, whether they're a Supreme Court justice or a senator or a congressman or a staffer or you know, a lobbyist, whatever. And that cynicism, I mean, these are people. The importance of that personal interaction, just the life experience that goes on all day, every day, having gay clerks change their perspective.
And that leads to sort of the least cynical justice on the court, who I think is David Souter, you know, who leads this monastic existence, mm-hmm. the only bachelor justice. He'd never heard of Diet Coke when he arrived. He'd never heard of the Supremes. He doesn't like electric light. He moves his chair around his chambers to catch the light over the course of the day. And it was Souter who was so devastated by Bush v. Gore, because he has this idealistic notion of the court. And sure, people can disagree, but he thought that was such a cynical maneuver that he actually thought about resigning the court. So, you know, some people are more cynical than others, and Souter is not.
Well, I raise that because it seems that that's one of the challenges, particularly as, you know, the professionalization you referred to earlier, the fact that these are all now have all been trial judges or judges, which was as I think you said, has never been the case before.
First time in history. Yeah.
That is a much more constrained perspective on the world than has historically been the case. You do that in an environment that also is Washington, which is sort of a hothouse in itself. Pile on a dose of cynicism, and it seems that the institution itself is under some threat just by virtue of the narrowing of focus, particularly if you add in these now political influences that are just laser-like in trying to enforce perspectives. And you know, that's a problem. That's really the question. Is there a way around this? Can we find ways of ventilating the space?
You know what? I don't
move
think
them to
so.
Kansas or something?
I don't think so. I think that's sort of as it should be. I think the court is a political institution. It's insulated in some ways, but it can't be insulated in every way. You know, Stephen Breyer is the only justice who always goes to the State of the Union address, and he says he does it for a reason. He says, "Look, we are part of the government. We can't pretend that we're not, and the justices don't like going. It's awkward about whether to applaud or not. They just feel out of place." But Breyer says, "No, we are a part, and we need to show people we're a part."
And that's part of the struggle that's going on now, just in terms of what is that appropriate balance. We talk about the balance of these three very importantly different branches of our federal government, but that is always in tension, isn't it?
Always, but the issue is, how political is that controversy? The tension is inevitable. Is it also political tension? And I think the answer is absolutely yes.
Absolutely yes. Let's go away and come back in just a moment for a final couple of minutes with Jeffrey Toobin. Be with us. A couple more minutes with Jeffrey Toobin. I have, over the years, had a lot of young people come to me and say, "I want to be on television. I want to be a reporter." And I say, "Well, what do you know?" And they say, "Well, I went to J school." I say, "But what do you know?"
Right.
And as I have followed you both through The New Yorker and when you were at ABC and CNN, and your parents are out of the broadcast business, don't you have to know something to be a good reporter?
Yes, you do. But I don't think you need to be a lawyer to be a good reporter. I mean, I have my own niche. I do law. You know, my colleague Sanjay Gupta does medicine. You know, I think mostly what you need is sort of street smarts and intense curiosity. If you can learn, you never have all the facts you need, but you have the intelligence and the curiosity and the sort of chops to find out what you need to know. That's more important than any sort of specific education, I think.
All of which Jeffrey Toobin has done, all of which we thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Nine, does indeed take us inside the secret world of the Supreme Court, including much that must not be secret if we are to be free. We are grateful Mr. Toobin has spotlighted this crucial branch of our government and thank him for joining us for this conversation. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.